The recording has been started. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Joni. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the IGO and GOQ Device Protection PDP Working Group meeting on the 10th of March 2015. On the call today, we have Peter Reinforth, George Kirikas, Val Sherman, Jim Bykoff, Phil Corwin, Paul Tattersfield, Jay Chapman, David Maher, Kathy Kleiman, and David Heasley. We have apologies from Christine Durain and Mason Cole. And from staff, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, and myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you so much, and over to you, Peter.
Thanks. Peter here. Any new statements of interest? I see no hands up. Okay, so the main topic of today is to review the international law expert response on the specific questions that we sent out. And I hope that you all have had the time to study the replies to our specific questions. I know that George Kirikas has at least done that, and thanks for your comments. I would like to deal with it this way so that we don't miss anything. I'd leave it to Mary to make some initial comments first, and then I prefer to go through the specific topics, and then I'll give it out to general comments afterwards, so that we don't miss our questions and the replies that we got to that, and see what's left and what we may want to have further comments on the law expert, or how we want to deal with it. So if that's okay with you, I'll give it up to Mary first.
Thank you, Peter. Hi, everybody. This is Mary from ICANN staff. So as he noted, just introductory comments, not getting into the substance of the questions or the response, but I think two things. One is why we reached out to Mr. Correll, and secondly, the expectations of Phil, Petter, and staff when we did do so. First, so Mr. Correll has been someone who's given advice off and on to ICANN, so we knew of him, but neither Steve nor myself had had any personal interactions with him prior to this. When we were asked to look for experts to help the group with the sovereign immunity issue, Mr. Correll's name came up, in part because we knew that he would be able to give us a relatively fast response, as he's done. When we did reach out to him with the questions that Phil and Petter also reviewed and commented on, our expectation was that this would not be a full legal opinion, partly, again, because of the time issue, but also because we felt that it would be very difficult for anyone, whether it's Mr. Correll or somebody else, to really provide us with clear information quickly if we had to go into all the, you know, what this group is up to, what we've done, what the background is, and some of the more specific details. So our expectation was that there would be follow-up based on whatever the initial response that would come back. We felt comfortable that Mr. Correll would at least give us some sort of guideline, at least an initial sort of direction, because of his qualifications, having been in the UN system and now being out of it, so he would actually, we felt, know a lot more about the actual IGO workings than perhaps other experts. This is not to say that the group should not reach out to other experts as well, and as Steve and I were talking to Phil and Petter before this call today, staff is happy to do so. So we expect that there will be other action items, including a follow-up, perhaps with Mr. Correll, perhaps an investigation into other avenues of research, and also with the IGOs and with the GAC. So the final introductory remark I'll make, Peter, is that to the extent that we look for additional opinions, including full opinions that include judicial citations and so forth, it's not so much the cost issue, which is obviously not a working group concern as much, but it will probably take some time, and if it's something that we need to do, then yes, we'll do it, but just so that everyone knows that that will take time, first to get an expert to agree to do it, and secondly, to allow them the time to do a thorough job. So over back to you, Peter.
Thank you for that. Well, as you saw from his CV, Mr. Correll is a former Swedish diplomat, but I have nothing to do with the juice of using him as to outreach to. And as working as a legal counsel for the United Nations, which is, in fact, one of the IGOs. So, and as you could see, he has not dealt with the main dispute so much, but he had at least two cases that he mentioned. One was that was sold without going to any dispute resolution procedures. What could be interesting there is to see a little bit more details on how the other dispute was actually settled. If we then start with, as you could see, his focus was on the United Nations, and but at least that's as one of the IGOs, although it may be one that has a very very special role in this compared to other IGOs. And he initially refers to the regulations there where the United Nations, its property and assets wherever located and by whomsoever held, shall enjoy immunity from every form of legal process, except insofar as in any particular case it has expressly waived its immunity. And that's, of course, interesting to note, but on the other hand, my personal question, how does they work when they buy, let's say, copy paper for their office and make traditional, normal day-to-day business deals? There must be some cases where they have statements that are not focused by this. And also, when it comes to disputes, that's maybe more interesting for us for our topic, that the UN had offered a settlement out of court, and this is normally done through arbitration. I will say that when it comes to the at least when it comes to the UDRP, that is a similar way to actually deal with disputes. So his answer to question number one, when we wanted to know if there is a difference when a claim of sovereign immunity is asserted by an IGO when defending a complaint brought against it, in contrast to a case when an IGO files the complaint itself and thereby arguably submits to the jurisdiction of a national court. He has referred to the what is said initially in the documents, that they try to avoid this and to settle such disputes. And as I said again, I don't see any problems there when it comes to the UDRP, because it's actually not a traditional court action. But compared to if you want to go further to a national court, that's where we have to find a solution. So that's question one. In short, I open the floor to any specific comments on that. Yes, George, please go ahead.
Hi, George Kriegless speaking. Apologies for my voice, I've got a cold. I made a more detailed response to the mailing list, but I think his answer is not entirely correct, given that he's only referring to cases where Section 29 applies, where the UN is a party to a contract, and you know, something like the UDRP or any other kind of dispute where it's not a party to a contract, his answer just doesn't apply. And also, I sent an email to the list regarding a Canadian law case, which kind of picks apart his argument that the IGOs enjoy immunity on an absolute level in the first place, and I leave that to the list for discussion.
Thanks, George. Just a comment that when we talk about part of a contract, I mean, it's when... once you file a UDRP, you also, in fact, sign up and accept the regulation issues of it. So once you do that, I presume you can say that you have signed up for a contract. George, do you have any?
Hagen, can you restate that? I didn't quite make it out. I was kind of answering.
Sorry, once you file a UDRP, you also actually accept the regulations and how the dispute will be done and where you can go further with the case. So you sign up for a contract, and you can avoid that by not filing a UDRP.
Right, but the United Nations, George Kriegel speaking. But the United Nations is not a party to that contract. They're a third party beneficiary, but they're not an actual party to that contract. Are you familiar with the difference between a third party beneficiary and a party? That's like a legal concept that maybe one of the
okay,
the lawyers can weigh in on, but it doesn't make them a party.
So that's what I mean. Okay. So let's go on to question two. Is there the specific instance described in question one of an IGO's needing to agree to submit a national jurisdiction under the UDRP an example of a situation where an IGO would be compelled to waive its immunity in order to defend its rights? And well. He more or less make the same reply as to question one. So then IGO is not compelled to waive this immunity as long as it offers another method of settling the dispute. So if my comments there, if we are going to proceed with the work here, instead of a local court action, a UDRP dispute may be amended to be appealed, so to say, to another arbitrator. But I see, I think Mary was first, please.
I had a more general comment, so maybe you can go to Phil and then come back to me.
Okay. Phil?
Thanks, Peter. Phil, for the record. just want to, based on his response, he's saying, well, an IGO can agree to arbitration because it's not a national court. Well, and he seems to say, and he says, what we're talking about is like arbitration. Actually, it is arbitration. So if an IGO brought a UDRP, let's use as an example, and didn't get the result it wanted, it's its choice. You know, it goes against a domain that it thinks is infringing. It doesn't win the UDRP. It's up to the IGO whether they want to use the available appeal mechanism, which is a national court. So they don't have to do it if they don't want to, you know, dent their sovereign immunity. So this kind of relates to what I've observed in the past. The real situation we have to deal with would be the extremely rare case where an IGO alleges that a domain is infringing, wins the UDRP or URS, and then the registrant appeals. That if it's clearly infringing, the registrant probably wouldn't spend the time and the money to appeal, but we have to deal with it because, you know, there'll be 1 out of 1,000 instances where it'll happen. You know, so that was my comment, and, you know, just to remind everyone what the real issue is going to be with sovereign immunity. It's going to be the rare case where arbitration filed, the IGO loses. No, I mean, the IGO wins, and the registrant decides to appeal.
Thanks, Phil. And as you said, there are extremely rare cases we're talking about, but we need to find some kind of solution there. Okay, Mary, you said you had a general comment, so is it okay if I pass on to Katie first?
Sure. Go ahead.
Get it.
Terrific. Thanks. Really interesting discussion. I was wondering if we could get statistics on how many times a registrant has gone to court just generally in the UDRP proceeding and maybe what percentage of UDR proceedings that represents, because that may help the GAC feel better about different types of recommendations that may come, that we're talking, as Beth Petter and Phil said, about a very unusual situation. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. I think personally it's very good proposal, actually, to get that information. And when we, because we need, anyway, come back to the IGOs and GAC with additional questions, and that's actually one information that could be interesting to hear if they have any comments on. It may be that the risk is extremely low, but it's there, and that's why they cannot accept to use the system. Now, Mary, finally, how about you?
Thanks, Petter. Actually, let me start with a partial response to Kathy. I agree it would be very helpful. My understanding is that no body or person actually tracks that for reasons that you can imagine, because there are multiple jurisdictions in which losing registrants might go to file a court action, and it could be, you know, before the determination, or it could be an appeal after. WIPO does have a very partial list of some of the cases that have gone to court, and I haven't looked at it in a while, but my impression is that it's illustrative, but it's not particularly useful for the purpose that we might want to use it for. So I don't actually know that there would be not just an easy way, but that would be a workable way to get that kind of information across multiple jurisdictions. On the more general point I was going to make, it goes back somewhat to George's comments as well as his notes by email, and that is that in the course of our preliminary research into this issue, and I want to stress that we were doing this as ICANN policy staff, we were certainly not looking at it with a legal lens as such, because that's not our role. It seems like two things might be relevant. One is that the scope of sovereign immunity as applied to whether it's governments or IGOs can be different across different courts and jurisdictions. In other words, there is no single universal defined limit or scope of what sovereign immunity would mean. And so this goes to, I think, some of George's points about getting some sense from different court cases what that might be. And thank you for bringing to our attention the Canadian case, George. The second point I wanted to make is that even for IGOs themselves, or as the international law usage customarily has it, IOs or international organizations, they are highlighted in a lot of the laws and treaties like the Vienna Conventions, but there is some distinction and nuanced differentiation between what they are. I think George also highlighted this. So, for example, there are some IGOs that would be like the UN or WTO or something like that. In other words, they are set up by treaty and all their constituents or their members are governments. But there are also organizations that are set up by treaty, right, that may have some governments as its members but may also have what international law calls other entities. And that is something that just is the way it is. I don't know that it would be a good idea for this working group to split the list of IGOs such as it is, but I thought that those two points, first that there's no single universal scope for sovereign immunity, and that secondly, even the nature of an IGO isn't necessarily similar across the board as well, might be something useful for the group to know. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. Okay, coming to our question number three, it seems to me that we have more or less already discussed that. It was, if it's relevant, that the UDRP permits both the complainant and the respondent to bring an action in a court of competent jurisdiction at any time, and that the pre-appeal filing of such an action immediately suspends the UDRP proceeding. Well, his reply was just more or less a question if he needed to know to what extent IGOs have accepted the UDRP proceedings. We have discussed that. We have at previous meetings also seen some cases, also what we said today, that well, you can accept the UDRP proceeding, and you can accept the result of that case. What we need to get more info on and find a solution for, if necessary, is the very few cases where the domain holder is the losing part and wants to proceed to a court action. So, and then question number four, how do IGOs handle clauses providing for submission to jurisdiction and choice of law and standard form and mass market contracts? Well, there was, in fact, no specific reply to that question. Maybe a question that we should rather put forward to IGOs and or to GAC to see if we can have a specific reply to that. And then question number five, in view on the sovereign immunity issue, what are the generally recognized forms of action that IGOs are likely to pursue when they believe their rights are infringed? And he refers to just the two cases that he has dealt with. He said that an attempt would rather be made to solve issues amicably. If that doesn't work, it would be necessary to resort to kind of dispute settlement mechanisms foreseen under existing immunity provisions. As we have said, the UDRP issue is actually a way to deal with disputes in that way. And question number six, what, if any, are the factors that may limit or impact the applicability of a sovereign immunity claim by an IGO? And he generally said the immunity is there, and it's not a question of limiting it. And when he then said also that my spontaneous reaction is that it would be possible for them to use these procedures in case there are disputes, on the understanding that the procedures cannot entail a general waiver of immunity. In other words, disputes would have to be settled exclusively by the panels nominated under the procedures. I presume that, again, that he's talking about the UDRP as such, but we ask for comments in case any part would like to take the case to a court action in the country of the registrar or the domain holder. As George said, we have. It was interesting to see these initial comments from someone that had worked with UN on the legal aspects, not so much on the main disputes, but. At least with some recognition of that. And then I turn over to George and your comments that you emailed us just before the meeting, if you want to make any further aspects on that.
Sorry, I was muted again. George Kriegel speaking. I think the email sent with the Supreme Court of Canada decision, which was relatively recent, 2013, and which was unanimous 9-0, had a good coverage and background on the legal principles, and it cited not just Canadian law, but also the international treaties and various textbooks and academic authorities. So I think it provides a good counterpoint to the document provided by the legal expert in terms of what the actual state of the law is, rather than his anecdotal analysis.
Thanks. So now we've come to more of the next step, and as we all have noticed, this is initial replies, maybe not so much a specific answer to our questions. But one thing that we could do is to come back to him with a subsequent set of questions, versus noting, summarizing the IGO's position in the matter, and maybe also to refer to some specific cases so that he could provide us with the more detailed input there. Also, what I think may be a good thing to do once we have got his further inputs, is to reach out to GAC and IGOs to see if they have their own reports and maybe. We have discussed if we should reach out to another expert, but may well be that that GEC or and or IGOs also have some report that or paper that that they can refer to, or at least to answer on or additional questions on this. Mary.
Hi, Peter. Hi, everybody. I just wanted to respond to Paul Keating's question in the chat, just in case there are folks who are not in Adobe. And Paul's question was whether ICANN can provide funding to hire competent counsel to give us an opinion, presumably a more detailed one than this, which is, like I mentioned earlier, we had hoped that this would be either informative or preliminary or a bit of both. Paul, basically what would happen if we wanted to do that is, of course, the answer is yes, we can pursue that avenue. What Steve and I would need to do is then coordinate and brief our legal department, because then it would go through them. And I think a couple of people on this group were on the original IGO working group, where we did also seek legal advice pertaining to the laws of several different jurisdictions on particular points. So, like I mentioned earlier, this would take a bit of time, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it, but that is what we would need to do. And in order to do that, what this group would need to come up with is very specific questions. First of all, to make it clearer what the scope is that we're looking for, and secondly, obviously, to expedite the process as much as possible to avoid delays in sort of clarifying questions back and forth. So what we could do, if that's the direction the group wants to go, is start with these questions and do some filling in and be as specific as we possibly can, because our past experience has been that that the kind of external opinion that we get can be very detailed, but the extent of its utility does depend on how concrete the questions were in the first place. So I hope that helps.
Better. Jim Bykoff, can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
I was going to say that I agree with George's original comment. I don't think this opinion by Mr. Cornell was very helpful, and I'm not sure that coming up with more detailed questions would get us any further. I still believe that the best way to handle this is not by trying to hire experts or get others who have some claimed expertise, but to go back to the GAC and the IGOs and give them some very detailed questions about what stops them or what their point is as far as why they feel they do not have access to this remedy. We know that some IGOs have filed UDRPs. The World Bank, I think George brought this case to our attention, filed the UDRP some years ago. So it must have looked at the requirements and decided that it would take advantage of it, and they had access, and they got a decision. There are some others that have also brought cases. So it's not – I don't think we can say that IGOs do not have access to the procedure. Some may choose to use it, and perhaps they would not file an appeal if they lost, because, again, that would subject them to national jurisdiction. But – they have filed, so they do have access. And I think they should be answering these questions themselves, and so should the GAC. And I don't know why we wouldn't take this directly to those two entities and try to find out what they believe are the obstacles to access that are posed to IGOs. Thank you.
Thanks. I see Mary's hands up.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks, Jim. Even though staff doesn't get a vote on this, I feel that I should say that we do think that this would be a very good time to bring very specific questions, including possibly something like what Paul just typed in the chat, back to the GAC and to the IGOs. And I just wanted to remind group members that we're talking about two related but different groups, in that The GAC is governments and the IGOs are organizations in which the governments are members. And the GAC has, you know, made that distinction before. So I would suggest that we bring, if not the same questions, at least, you know, tailored questions back to the two of them. And I say this as staff because of, you know, experience just kind of helping out with different PDPs and looking at what has been happening with Mason as the intermediary and the sort of willingness of the GAC and the IGOs to engage, maybe tentatively for the GAC, but certainly we've gotten a response from the IGOs, and it would be good to follow through on that. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. Phil?
Yeah, thanks. Phil, for the record. A couple of comments. One, taking note of the comments in the chat room and emails that have been exchanged, I too am somewhat underwhelmed by what Mr. Carell has given us back. I'm not against going back with a second round of more precise questions for him, but I'm dubious that we'll get much in the way of additional guidance. So I think we need to think about you know, other resources to educate us on this besides our own research. Second, I think, yeah, it's good to ask the, well, certainly the GAC and the IGOs, they're separate. The IGOs may have more expertise here. I'm not relying on the GAC representatives for expertise in this area. The GAC obviously is more political clout within ICANN. I'm a little hesitant on sending them questions yet. I'm not sure we have quite the level of understanding we need to ask really detailed, focused questions, because I think the IGOs will tend to give us general, self-serving responses unless we really pin them down on specific points. But I'll leave that to the group to sit, to decide if we're at that point yet. We have some anecdotal evidence in the terms of knowledge of some UDRPs filed by IGOs, some court decisions which touch on the sovereign immunity. I'm just saying that I think we're not going to send a series of inquiries to the IGO, so I want to make sure that when we do send them, they're really focused questions. Having said that, I'll leave it to the group as to when we've reached that point, and raise the issue of whether there's anyone within the group, either now or at some point when we're ready to do that, who wants to get involved with drafting those questions for review by the group before they go to the IGOs. And I'll stop there.
Thanks, Phil. I have a follow-up question there. You said that we should reach out to other resources, and obviously you don't meant to reach out to Corral again. And if I understand you correctly, you also wanted to wait a bit to come back to IGOs or GAC with this issue.
Clarify, I'm not against going back to Carell, though I have some doubts that we'll get much more in the way of guidance beyond the very limited guidance he's given us here. And by his own admission, he's been kind of out of this area for a couple of years. Second, I'll defer to the group. I just want to make sure that when we go, again, I think the IGOs, if we just ask general questions, we're going to get vague, self-serving answers for them. If we go back with very targeted questions saying, well, what about this? These instances where IGOs use the UDRP? What about these court decisions or law review articles stating that your immunity is not absolute but is limited by various factors? And, you know, I think we need to pin them down. Otherwise, we're going to get general answers that favor their position, and they seem to want a whole new CRP for themselves with no national court playing a role at all, and I'm not sure we need to go that route if we find that the right of appeal in the UDRP and the ORS, which would only be exercised against them by a third party in a very rare and unusual circumstance, does not rise to a level where we need to create a whole new CRP.
Can I answer, Phil?
Thanks for that.
Jim Bykoff.
Yeah, Jim.
I want to say I think we have more than anecdotal evidence. I think we have actual cases. I think we have actual court cases as well as UDRP cases. And I think we have enough that we could. I agree with Phil that we should not go with very general questions because we'll probably get very general answers, but I think we can go with very specific questions and find out why it is that some IGOs are using the process, whereas others may not think they can use it. I think we can try to get more information as to why there's an inconsistency here. It would be different if no IGO has ever filed a UDRP, but we know that's not the case. And we can look at the court cases, and we can look at the UDRPs, and come up with some pointed questions, I think.
Yeah, and just responding quickly, besides knowing of the cases, we know that there's specific language in the URS that we discussed on the last call, which clearly gives them standing to bring a URS, and we have done research. We've come to believe that the IGOs covered by the Paris Convention have a form of right sufficient to bring a UDRP, but we've also discussed adding a clarification to the UDRP to make that clear. So the standing issue really is not one that in any way justifies creating a whole new CRP in my mind. And I think that's the general consensus in this group. So, you know, are we at the point where people think we have enough knowledge of this to prepare a set of questions for the IGOs that they can't just respond to in a general way?
Peter, thanks. It seems that we have come to that conclusion, and that's a better next step to do rather than to go back to the expert with additional specific questions. And I also saw George propose that perhaps we should start talking about functional immunity taken from the Supreme Court of Canada ruling to narrow things further instead of saying sovereign immunity. Well, it's as I said, it seems that we all conclude that we should reach out to GAC and IGOs with more specific questions. And then, of course, we can use also the materials and the examples we have collected as per today. I think one part of that would be also to refer to some cases where IGOs have been involved to get specific inputs on how that had worked and why it, if not, could not work for others. George.
Hi, George Griegel speaking. I noticed an important point on page number 4 of the expert's answers, where he said that irrespective of the fact that they are considered international, they still have to be registered somewhere, which means that they would be subject to the jurisdiction of their host state in the matters that we now discuss. I think that's a bit of a tip-off that they are still subject to some jurisdiction. So, and that was kind of a limitation on the scope of their claimed immunity. And it's actually very consistent with that Supreme Court of Canada decision where, in the case of Canada, the Government of Canada would enter into an agreement with any IGO that is situated, that has, for example, offices in Canada. And so there's some agreement. And so it seems as though, well, they were talking about in the context of NGOs, but I think it probably also refers to IGOs, that there is still some of that jurisdiction aspect that perhaps you didn't fully appreciate.
Thanks, George. That's a good point. Definitely something that we should note on and have as a specific question or note when we go back to the GAC and IGOs. And it seems, to make some kind of conclusion here, it seems that we should definitely the next step to reach out to GAC with the more specified questions based on what we have concluded so far, and also in that have some examples from the real life of disputes and the legal aspects. Then just a practical question I turned on to Mary. There is a specific group within GAC that represents the IGOs and work with these specific questions. When we reach out to GAC, can we do it in two different ways? Also reach out to the IGOs representatives, or do we have to, so to say, formally do it directly to GAC?
Petter, this is Mary. I think, and this is talking off the top of my head, I can't recall the questions that we had sent to the GAC that we're awaiting a response on. I think what we would need to do as a group and with you and Phil as the co-chairs is figure out what would be the most streamlined way of doing so, certainly in the way of follow-up. And it may be that we, you know, resend the initial questions with a supplement or an annex of some sort. So I suggest that we give that a bit of a think because, you know, we don't, I think to send the GAC a couple of different series of questions would probably lead to further delay in any possible response to us. So on that point, hopefully when you give it a bit of a think, we can come up with something that's helpful. That shouldn't prevent us from following up with the IGOs, though, and I suggested in the chat that if there's a small group of volunteers who are willing to work on it, you know, staff can certainly start the draft, but maybe in the next couple of weeks we can have several people trying to refine it and then bringing it back to the working group so as not to hold up the working group discussion on other matters, if that would work.
Okay, thanks. So, we'll lead further with it and come up that we can maybe discuss in the next meeting the new and the follow-up questions to GAC, either directly, either only directly to GAC, or if we also can put it to onto the group that within the GAC that works specifically on the IGOs aspects. And then, if nobody else has any specific things to add to this, I think we need to pass on to the next topic on the agenda. I saw George's question. Yes, we had a follow-up wrap-on on our discussion about the UDIP-URS differences. My personal view is that I think we have more or less discussed that enough. What we have is the initial view of the differences, and we have the additions. So if we can put together just a final report with where we can see the differences so that we can say that we have actually done this this overview of the differences. But I don't know, if George, do you have any specific comments and questions that? I see Katie Sands is up. Yes, please.
I'm happy to wait for George if he wants to answer first. Doesn't look like. Okay. I just wanted to ask if we might, in addition to highlighting kind of detailed differences or similarities between the URS and the UDRP, highlight the different policy objectives of the two policies and the scope of the impact of the two policies, because that's very different. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. So what you suggest is that we add that to the report, so to speak, or do you think that's also something that we need to discuss first?
Add that to our final report? Is that what we're talking about?
The paper we've been working with,
yes.
Showing the differences.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, because I think people need to know what the, and it looks like Jay's volunteered me, so, people definitely need to know that URS applies only to new GTLDs and was part of the application guidebook, and that's what it applies to, whereas the UDRP applies to new and old GTLDs. And maybe something about the tie-in of the URS and the Trademark Clearinghouse as well, which is, of course, unique, and the UDRP doesn't have anything like that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Excellent. Mary?
Hi, it's Mary again. Just to follow up on Kathy's points as well, I just wanted to remind folks that part of our charter, and Petter, you, Phil, Steve, and I did talk about this briefly, does request that this group consider the fact that, as Kathy said, the URS only applies to the new Gs, whereas the UDRP also applies to the legacy GTLDs. So this may be something that we can take up in our discussion of whether and what we do about that particular charter task. And that may be a natural topic lead-in for the next few weeks if we're going to sort of take the sovereign immunity questions slightly offline and work on them while the group gets on with the rest of the work as well. So just a suggestion there, Petter.
Thanks. That's excellent. And what we also discuss is that we want to just update our working group agenda. Some of the questions we have on that we have solved more or less. And some other questions might take a little bit more time, but I think so to you, as of today, we're not behind the time in any of the topics. Okay, Phil?
Yeah, just in response to Mary on just noting again that the UDRP applies to both new and incumbent legacy GTLDs because it's a consensus policy, whereas the URS, while it looks like just another arbitration procedure, was an implementation detail of the new TLD program and could only be extended to legacy GTLDs if it became a consensus policy. And we can, the whole group can discuss it, but I've stated before that I think that's a major step that is really not appropriate for this group and is something I think it will be addressed when there's an issues report on the RPMs and if there's a subsequent PDP based on that to review the RPMs and the UDRP. And in fact, there was a decision by the GNSO Council to put off any UDRP policy review until they had substantial experience with the new RPM. So I don't think I just want to state that for the record, but we can certainly get into any other aspects of URS, but making it available at .com and others would be something I think a bridge too far for this group.
Phil, I want to just add on to your comments, Jim Bykoff. The right now, the intellectual property constituency of ICANN and the International Trademark Association are working on a response to the initial report on the RPM review, and one of the sections is on the URS. So there will be a reply by those two organizations, and one of the things that may very well be in that reply is that the URS would be far more attractive to trademark owners if it did apply to legacy GCLDs like .com and .org, because up to now, as everybody knows, there have been really very few URSs filed compared to UDRPs, and one of the reasons is it just applies to the GCLDs. So that may be where that's going to come out in the review. Anyway, I think that could be helpful to the group.
Yeah, and Jim, to respond, as you know, I'm a member of INTA's Internet Committee. I'm aware they're doing that. I'm going to be filing comments on that initial staff report for the Internet Commerce Association. We'll have something to say about URS. I wouldn't be surprised at all if at some point the ICANN community considers it applying to legacy TLDs, and I don't know what my the ICA or any other client might think of that. It seems to have been, administered in a responsible way so far. But all I'm saying is that's a big question, and I think that's kind of outside the focus of this group. And if we were to suddenly declare URS available at .com and others for IGOs, we'd be creating a precedent that could prejudice the whole subsequent discussion.
Yeah, I agree.
It's good to know. Karim, quick comment on that?
Yeah, no, I'm glad Phil said what he did, and it sounds like Jim agrees. While I've always been surprised that somehow it was in the scope of an IGO working group to relook at what was a very deep and contentious compromise from a group called the STI working group that created the URS, I would absolutely agree it's out of scope. And also, there's no notice to the rest of the ICANN community that somehow within the IGO working group we would be revisiting that kind of big question of URS and new GTLDs versus existing GTLDs. So plus one to Phil. Thanks.
Thanks. Good to know that there will be a number of inputs on that topic, and it seems that we can have some use for that also. Well, we have passed the full hour, and I just wanted to end with some good news. We have, as you know, we sent out requests for inputs on specific questions, and we have got a reply from the Registry's stakeholder group saying that the Registry's stakeholder group has been actively following this working group's proceedings and is satisfied with the current state of those efforts. As such, we don't have any comments to offer at this time. So thanks all of you for your satisfied work so far, and thanks for today.
Thank you. Goodbye, all.
Thanks, Petter. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. We now stop the recordings.